second case for oral argument this morning is William Guthrie, appellant, versus Douglas Weber, the warden of the South Dakota Penitentiary, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Michael Butler, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, Mr. Weber, we have Sherry Sundemall, an assistant attorney general, deputy attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Butler, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. On May 14th of 1999, at about 7 o'clock in the morning, William Guthrie called 911 to report that his wife was slumped over in the bathtub. Law enforcement and 911 proceeded to the scene. She died the next day after being taken off life support. An investigation followed that lasted at least 90 days. The grand jury was convened in late August. Over the course of the late spring and early summer, law enforcement obtained various kinds and types of evidence, including in late May, they sent subpoena Ducas Tecums to various drugstores asking for Mr. Guthrie's medical records. They were captioned "Investigation of Criminal Activity in Beadle County here in South Dakota." The statute cited for their authority to do this was 1-26-19.1, found in the administrative section of our code. As the summer months wore on, investigators interviewed a number of people, friends of the Guthries, work associates, Miss Guthrie, even a woman who Mr. Guthrie had an affair with. They prepared a lengthy affidavit. They went to the court and asked for permission to search Mr. Guthrie's residence, in addition to a computer in his office. This detailed affidavit outlines the interviews that were done. It said also that Sharon Guthrie had died from drowning. It said that Sharon Guthrie, the toxicology report, found a large quantity or amount of a drug called temazepam in her system. The amount was toxic but not lethal. It was believed that she lost consciousness and drowned in the bathtub. The search warrant that was issued in this case did result in the seizure of the computer. This yielded considerable evidence for the prosecution at trial. The evidence included that there had been internet searches on such subjects as household accidents, bathtub accidents, worst pills, best pills, a consumer's guide to avoiding drug-induced death or illness, a specific search for on or about temazepam. The prosecution, in their closing argument at trial, said this was the most damaging evidence in the case against Mr. Guthrie. Mr. Guthrie was convicted by a jury. He directly appealed to this court, and that conviction was affirmed by split decision in 2001. This habeas action now brought by Mr. Guthrie raises two questions concerning trial counsel's performance and whether it was constitutionally deficient in two respects. First, should he have challenged the seizure of the computer? Insofar as this, the affidavit contains no evidence that would indicate that there was a reasonable probability that that computer contained evidence of a conspiracy between Mr. Guthrie and Debbie Christensen, the woman with whom he had an affair. That was the stated reason on the last page of this lengthy affidavit given by law enforcement for wanting to look at the computer. And I will go back at length on that issue. The second challenge in this case was to the use of the subpoena Ducas Tecums to obtain prescription records and medical records. The state's attorney of Beadle County, when this case went before the circuit court for an evidentiary hearing, had taken the position that they were entitled, they had an absolute right to use subpoenas to obtain prescription records and medical records. And that had been their position throughout. The habeas court disagreed with that, ruling that prescription records, like privacy records, are within the zone of privacy such that a search warrant by a neutral and detached judge should issue upon a showing of probable cause. And a subpoena cannot be used to circumvent that requirement. However, the habeas court said that the error in this case was not fatal because there would have been an inevitable discovery of those prescription records by law enforcement. The court reasoned this way. Once they obtained the search warrant in late July of 99, they would have gone to Guthrie's home and found pill bottles. Having found the pill bottles, they in turn would have obtained a search warrant and then therefore got them inevitably and legally. In addition, the court said even if not inevitable discovery, harmless error applies because the evidence against Mr. Guthrie was otherwise overwhelming and the prescription records themselves not as consequential. As to the search warrant issue, the court did not engage in a harmless error analysis, rather simply ruled that there was probable cause. This court's standard of review is to not decide separately and independently for itself today whether it would issue the warrant. This court will give deference and draw all reasonable inferences from the affidavit to see, in fact, if it is supported by probable cause to believe, one, was there a crime, which in this case certainly there was evidence that would support suspicion on that level. But more importantly and secondly, were there facts contained within the affidavit that would lead one to conclude the office computer of Mr. Guthrie probably contained evidence of this crime? Herein lies the heart of our challenge. Page 9 of this affidavit speaks to the interview done of Debbie Christensen, who lived in Nebraska, the woman with whom Mr. Guthrie had had an affair that was undisputed. It was admitted both by Guthrie and Christensen. Christensen said the affair ended in January of 1999, 4 or 5 months before the death of Sharon. She gave information that she talked frequently with Mr. Guthrie by telephone, including his effort to contact her after Sharon passed away to see if they could get together again. Now, the court, when they went for this search warrant, they say to the judge in the last paragraph, we want to look at Mr. Guthrie's computer for evidence of a conspiracy between him and Debbie Christensen. So in examining this question, there's two things to look at. First, was there evidence of a conspiracy? And two, would we find it on the computer? As to the first question, other than the fact of the affair, there was nothing in this affidavit linking Debbie Christensen to the crime. There was nothing pointing to any physical evidence. There was nothing indicating they had searched her home. There was nothing indicating Debbie Christensen even owned a computer. Nonetheless, she had had an affair. And the question there would be, is that in and of itself enough reason to believe she also conspired with Mr. Guthrie to murder Sharon? If you go back 2 pages in that affidavit to page 7, there is another important piece of information. Dee Dee Guthrie, a daughter, told law enforcement in her interview that Debbie Christensen had called her father and asked him to preside at Debbie Christensen's upcoming wedding. She was getting married to another man. This was upsetting to her mother. That, in and of itself, those facts would seem to mitigate less toward Debbie being involved in trying to kill Sharon Guthrie than would. But now we'll move to the next question. Why would Guthrie's office computer, what leads us to believe the office computer contains evidence of that conspiracy? There's nothing in this affidavit that even indicates whether Mr. Guthrie was hooked up to the internet. This is 10 years ago, 1999. It wasn't certainly as commonplace as it is today. Whether he used electronic mail, whether Debbie Christensen had a computer even, or used electronic mail. Nothing. The habeas court said there was sufficient cause for two reasons. The suspicion that those two may have been involved in a conspiracy. And two, the computer is a means of communication, and therefore they should be allowed to get it.
Who owned the computer?
The church.
Does that make a difference?
The state argued it did. The court found it did not. It found that Mr. Guthrie had standing, as he was the only one who would use that computer in his office that was connected to the home.
But there was evidence of correspondence. One of the daughters, I think, said that Debbie Christensen was sending him love letters and cards. And could we infer then that since they were having an affair, that he would be also sending her love letters and cards?
Perhaps so, but the fact that they were sending letters would suggest to me that they didn't communicate by email more than it does.
Well, is it just email? I'm looking at the affidavit. It says on the last page, the paragraph you were quoting from, it says, we would like to search for any correspondence. And couldn't the court think that a computer could be used to prepare correspondence, whether it's electronic or written? I mean, it's hard to find typewriters in the last 20 years. If he wanted to type it, he'd have to type it on a computer.
And to dovetail on that, it's in the same sentence that we would like to examine the diary kept by William Guthrie of his activities and the computer he uses in his office for evidence of any conspiracy. Doesn't the diary and the computer become kind of the place where he may have kept some of his drafts of love letters or whatever? I mean, I see it as more the diary and the computer as opposed to the email.
Well, I'm talking about the computer. First off, I'm just speculating on whether they were looking for email because nothing in the affidavit suggests they ever communicated in that way. Nothing indicates, as I stated a moment ago, that Debbie Christensen even owned a computer. And she gave a consensual interview, and apparently one could reasonably infer they never bothered to ask. So now you go back and say, well, does Mr. Guthrie use this computer to correspond in some fashion? Where in the affidavit would there be some justification for reaching that conclusion? That this was the specific reason given. Evidence of a conspiracy to commit murder.
Are we limited to that, though? I mean, we can look at the fact that they were having an affair, that they were communicating. They even communicated after his wife died. Ms. Christensen said that one of the reasons they broke off the relationship is because she told Guthrie that she didn't think he was going to ever divorce his wife, and so she didn't want to hang around. And then the court knows that there's correspondence that's going one way. Couldn't they infer there's correspondence going the other way, too? And wouldn't the correspondence be naturally found on a computer?
As to the first point that you made, that the relationship was broke off, according to Debbie Christensen, at most what that provided is a basis for a motive for Mr. Guthrie, not to conclude she was conspiring to commit murder. Secondly, the evidence in here about correspondence, generally speaking, again, is not linked to the computer. Does it indicate, is it handwritten correspondence? Not said. Is it typed correspondence? Not said. Does it indicate it came off a computer? Not said. So what we're doing, again, is just saying, well, it's possible.
Well, Mr. Butler, that brings us, I think, right to the heart of the case. Because you say, not said. This was not said in the affidavit. That was not said in the affidavit. But in each case, you're asking about reasonable inferences having not been said in the affidavit. Yet the United States Supreme Court requires the judge or the magistrate to make a common sense determination of those rational inferences. It doesn't say that every rational inference that the judge makes must be set forth in the affidavit. And it seems to me that's what you're asking us to do. You're asking us to adopt a rule that every reasonable inference has to be in the affidavit, or the judge can't make such an inference, him or herself. Isn't that effectively what you're asking us to do?
No, I'm not. It's not just a question of looking at a statement and saying the only inference that I can draw is what literally appears. Okay, correspondence. You still have to have facts if you want to make the next leap. That's what the courts say, facts. What fact is there in here other than now what has been identified, maybe correspondence or a diary, that tells you you're going to find evidence of criminal activity on the computer? What? I mean, I can read what Debbie Christensen told me.
You don't have to have evidence of criminal activity. It could be evidence that's evidence of criminal. I mean, it doesn't have to be the actual criminal activity. An actual conspiracy, just evidence of it.
Perhaps we're splitting hairs on that level. I think, as I read the cases, two things are required. Is there evidence indicating a crime occurred? And I'm not disputing that point in this case as an initial matter. But, and then two, what I would dispute, though, is that Debbie Christensen was involved in it. There is nothing in here that suggests that. And secondly, when you want a search warrant, you identify the place you want to search and why you think you're going to find something there. You still have to give a basis for saying, we believe that we can find evidence of criminal activity or something that would connect it in this case. And I am suggesting that nowhere in the affidavit can a judge make that inference. To say, well, yes, I think the computer would be a source of evidence in this case against Mr. Guthrie. And what they told the judge in that case is that it had to be, that they were looking at this, again, conspiracy. So if you're saying now, well, we don't have to even consider whether it's a conspiracy anymore, aren't we also then walking outside the four corners of the affidavit? We're still supposed to look and see what inferences the judge could draw. They didn't say in here that Guthrie was known to have used his computer to communicate in some fashion or what kind of information he stored on it. This is just what it says. We would like to see. We are curious if we could look at his computer. A computer is a protected thing which contains information. To suggest that in this case, curiosity is enough to invade that zone of privacy without more, I suggest, is clearly an error. I want to move on. I don't know how much time I have, frankly, but I want to get to my second issue.
We just have lights down here. We don't have a clock. I'm guessing you get about 7 minutes.
Three, okay.
I'm not a good guesser, sorry.
So I have to get 7 minutes worth of stuff in. I want to talk about the lower court's indication of inevitable, what it said about inevitable discovery with the prescription records. And the reason I believe the court was clearly wrong in reaching that conclusion. The position taken by the state and the prosecution in this case is they did not need a search warrant to get prescription records. That's what they believed then. That's what they argued to the court now. And to suggest that back then they would have changed their mind and gone for a search warrant is unsupported. In addition, the state never even claimed inevitable discovery before the lower court. No factual hearing was held. I think it probably would have been easy to question the people who were doing the search to find out if they would have got a search warrant.
Let me go right to that, because now that you brought that up, let's assume we agree with you that you can't use a subpoena as if it were a search warrant. Going then to the question of inevitable discovery, if we were to agree with you that the court didn't give you a chance to argue that issue because it raised it on its own, do you have some facts that you believe the court didn't consider, that should consider, that would merit a remand?
Well, the facts really that I just gave you, which is that they didn't believe then and they don't believe now. Or they certainly didn't believe when they came to court at the habeas hearing that they were required to get a search warrant. So to suggest that they would have, back up 9 years earlier, and said, once we found the pill bottles, let's go get a search warrant, they simply didn't agree that they had to. So to say they would have.
But I mean, what else would you? I mean, I'm asking you, what would, if we were to say, we want you to take this back to the trial court, is there something else that you think that the trial court, some fact that you'd like to present to the trial court that it didn't have a chance to consider?
I believe that the burden of proof on inevitable discovery falls with the party asserting it. And in this case, they didn't assert it. So whether it go back you'd have to, I guess, say now that they've met their burden. We don't need to go back and have a hearing.
So trial judge then, in effect, assumed facts that weren't even in evidence.
That was my position. It was sui sponte when he issued his written decision. It was never discussed,
ever
brought up.
There's nothing in the facts or nothing in the record that indicates they would have gotten a...
That's correct.
The courts have done this. Courts have done this sua sponte. They've raised this up several times. I think, I'm not sure I remember correctly, but I think the Supreme Court, or maybe the lower court, raised it on its own in various cases. So my concern is that what do we do with that? If we agree with you that the subpoenas were wrong, but we think it was unfair to you that the court just raised it on its own and decided it, is there any reason for us to send it back? Is there something you'd like to tell the judge or give the judge that the judge didn't have to consider?
What I would have done then is really what I'm doing now, which is to say, Judge, from what you have presented to you, what would lead you to believe that these agents thought they had to get a search warrant back then when they're still asserting through counsel for the state they don't have to get it? Why? That's not a reasonable inference to be drawn.
So, Justice Sinner, did you have another question? Okay, thank you, Mr. Broderick. Ms. Sundwall, do you have 20 minutes?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Sherry Sundwall, and I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the state of South Dakota. Petitioner appeals today from findings of fact, conclusions of law, and an order entered by Judge Tim Tucker denying his request for habeas corpus relief. Petitioner has raised two issues in reference to ineffective assistance of counsel. The first being that counsel was ineffective for failing to challenge the sufficiency of the affidavit to support the search warrant that established probable cause to seize the computer in the church office. The second issue surrounds whether counsel failed to challenge the state's use of the subpoena deus tecum to obtain petitioner's prescription drug records. In reference to the first issue, the habeas court found that the affidavit did indeed establish probable cause and upheld the search. As to the second issue, the lower court found that agents may have violated petitioner's privacy rights by obtaining prescription records through the use of a subpoena rather than a search warrant, but held that under inevitable discovery, the petition should be denied.
Let me ask you a question on the affidavit that supports the search warrant first. Is there anything on the four corners of that affidavit that would indicate they were looking for a crime other than the conspiracy crime?
Well, I think they were looking for motive. On page 11 of the affidavit, second to the last page, the agent says, I submit that a torrid romance carried on over a period of years would provide motive for Guthrie to want to be rid of his wife, Sharon, to be free and pursue something that was important enough to live a life with family and business associates for years. Again, on that same page, second to last paragraph, he once again says, in the days that followed, I think he's talking about the death of Sharon, information has come to the surface which put this death into a very suspicious light. William Guthrie has been found to be a blatant liar and has a motive, one of the world's oldest, lust for another woman that impaired his judgment and reasoning. What needs to be kept in mind is reference throughout this 12-page affidavit to the communications that were going on between Debbie Christensen and the petitioner. Love letters had been exchanged. I think there's testimony in the record that those two communicated daily by telephone, if not daily, 2 to 3 times at least a week. Debbie Christensen testified that she was spending a lot of money on telephone calls. Mr. Guthrie appeared to have made up some story about having been sexually assaulted in Nebraska and requested that his new congregation allow him to go down to Nebraska once a month for counseling. That, it would appear, was a basis for him to go down yet once again to see Debbie Christensen. This affair with Debbie Christensen went on for approximately 5 years. I think it started in 1994 and continued through 1999.
Is that all in this affidavit?
It is, Your Honor, it is. There was also numerous witnesses or people that law enforcement had talked to that talked about this affair. It was very well known by many people that petitioner was seeing Debbie Christensen. Critically, even petitioner and Debbie Christensen admitted that they had had the affair, and that is in the affidavit. And in reference to whether the affidavit supports a search warrant, what needs to be shown is that the information provided to the issuing court in the warrant application was sufficient for the judge to make a common sense determination, as Justice Zinner pointed out, that there's a fair probability evidence would be found on the person or the place to be searched. There's no specific formula as to the amount of evidence that's needed. I think Petitioner's counsel would have this court believe that unless they said we believe that there's information specifically on the computer to show a conspiracy, the court was out of bounds in order to sign the search warrant. I don't think the law requires that.
But that is what they asked for. I mean, just following up on Justice Meyer Henry's question, in the end, they're asking for evidence of a conspiracy. And what is there, you know, what, besides just saying the word, what is there in the affidavit that actually addresses anything about a conspiracy?
Well, the fact that the two were having an affair for 5 years, and that Debbie Christensen was hoping, it would appear that the two were hoping they could get together. In February, Debbie Christensen testified that she had, or didn't testify, but had given a statement that she had told him, if you ever leave Sharon, maybe we can get back together. That was her statement. Exactly what was actually going on, I think law enforcement were trying to figure that out at the time this affidavit was signed. They knew there had been an affair.
But it doesn't have to be a conspiracy. Aren't they looking, when you say they're looking for motive, isn't that enough that there could be some admission against interest, there could be some comment in there, reason to support motive, without any fault on the part of Debbie Christensen in relation to a conspiracy?
That's true. The specifics of the communications, while they were suspicious of a conspiracy, the suspicion was that was the basis for the desire to, for the determination to murder Sharon. And I think there's plenty of information or evidence in this record to support that thought process. What this court has held is that a probable cause is a fluid concept. The court is to make an assessment of the probability in the particular context. And here, they knew he was having an affair. They knew he was having communications. They didn't know for sure if it was by email, but they knew there was letters. They knew there were telephone calls. And they wanted to find out if there was communication on the computer as well. They were looking to see what kind of communications were taking place between the two of them beyond what they already knew.
They also asked for the diary. Was there ever a diary?
There is evidence in the affidavit that talks about he kept a diary. I'm not aware of what, if any, evidence generated from that diary, but there wasn't a diary that they were interested in finding. And one of the witnesses they testified to talked about him keeping this diary. And that was the basis for making that request. Probable cause to issue a warrant does not have to rise to a level of a prima facie case. It's a probability of criminal activity. I would submit to this court that there was sufficient evidence in the affidavit to justify this search, that the facts led a reasonable and a prudent person to believe there's a fair probability that a crime had been committed and evidence relevant to the crime would be uncovered by the search, including the computer. And, in fact, that happened. But critically, this court needs to examine the affidavit by the four corners of the affidavit itself. And that's just exactly what Judge Erickson did here. He found that there was fair probability of a murder and that the search of petitioner's office computer may reveal evidence of the crime. What they know is she died of drowning and drug overdose with large quantities of petitioner's prescription drugs in her body. The affidavit also revealed that petitioner was unkind to Sharon. He intended to divorce Sharon. He had sexual affairs with Christensen. There was considerable tension between these two. Petitioner had a bad temper. He was making frequent trips to Nebraska to see Debbie Christensen. He also invented the affair. This certainly was sufficient probable cause to issue the warrant in this case. This was not a bare-bones affidavit. There was more than speculation in the affidavit. There was certainly a suspicious nature to the death, and the drug overdose was certainly a reason to look beyond and look into the computer itself. In reference to the subpoena issue, unless the court has any other questions in reference to the affidavit, in reference to the issuance of the subpoena deuce taken for the prescription records. Again, I think it's important that this court understand what happened. Sharon died of drowning, aided by large amounts of petitioner's prescriptions for temazepam on May 14th. On May 17th, Beadle County Deputy State's Attorney goes to petitioner's home, and he asks them to pick up the bottles of prescriptions in the home. Petitioner's son-in-law, Les Hewlett, voluntarily agrees to do that and provides law enforcement with those prescription bottles. Those prescription bottles are picked up at 3 p.m. on the 17th. On May 19th, the state issues subpoenas to both Stats Drugs and Kmart, and they get copies of all the prescription drugs or prescription records. The subpoena does list it as having been issued under 126.19.1. I don't know, at the habeas hearing, it appears the state took the position, or the court certainly did, that that was a mistake. I don't know if there was some intent to think in terms of issuing that under Department of Health kinds of regulations, which obviously Department of Health has access to these records. But anyway, the habeas court took the position that there was a misciting and it should have been under 23A.14.5.
Do you agree with that at this point? Is the state conceding that?
I'm sorry, conceding which point, Your Honor?
That it should have been a search warrant as opposed to an administrative subpoena.
No, Your Honor, we are not. We are not. We are taking the position that prescription drug records, there is a zone of privacy that some courts have acknowledged. Certainly there can be a zone of privacy, but it's not an absolute zone of privacy. And I think that a search of cases around the country would show that courts have made certainly distinctions between financial records and prescription records and medical records, and that there is a basis for law enforcement being able to get subpoenas through a search warrant.
What do they have to show on those subpoenas? Is there any... What, they just issue the subpoena.
Right. It's not like an affidavit.
So they could issue a subpoena for any of our drug records or medical records? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think there's a distinction between medical records and prescription records. There's a limited expectation in prescription records. Those purchases are subject to government regulation and scrutiny, obviously because of doctor shopping concerns, because of prescription drugs being obtained by fraud and deceit and illicit means. The Department of Health, our legislature has set up a very regulated scheme in which Department of Health could go in and look at records to protect against doctor shopping and those kinds of things. So I think law enforcement has access to prescription records that it may not have to finance.
But, you know, this was in the course of a criminal investigation.
It was, Your Honor.
This was not a civil administrative proceeding. And I think courts all over the country have held that the standard, even within a civil administrative subpoena in the course of a criminal investigation, is the higher standard rather than just the willy-nilly thing that you would do in the course of a civil investigation.
There have been some courts that have acknowledged that a warrantless search of pharmacy prescription records does not violate constitutional right to privacy under the guise of the heavy regulation that comes with prescription drugs. The habeas court did not get to this issue. In fact, the court, it appears to me, looked at this more like a medical record and so did not, it did say that there may have been a violation of the Fourth Amendment rights, but did not decide this issue on that basis.
But this argument you're making today, that the subpoena cited the wrong statute, that argument wasn't made, was it? I don't even see that in your brief.
No, Your Honor, there was a question posed that said, are you taking the position that you can't get prescription records? And so I'm trying to respond to that question,
okay.
And I've gone into probably more depth than I should have because you're right. I did not address that issue in the brief because that's not how the court addressed the issue. The court held under inevitable discovery the state would have been able to get those records, and I submit that that's an accurate reflection and statement of the law.
Is a court entitled to raise an issue that the state denies sua sponte and then rule against the defendant?
Well, this court uses right for the wrong reason principles sometimes, and perhaps that would be, although that wasn't right for the wrong reason, if they were right. Maybe the state didn't argue the right basis for the subpoena being the basis upon which you get the records, but the court got it right.
But doesn't the state have a burden of proof, and by the court sua sponte doing it sort of relieves the state of that burden?
Well, the state took the position that they could get these records under HIPAA, and the court rejected that argument. But the court said you can get them under, you would have gotten them under inevitable discovery under the record that we have here.
But didn't the defense have a right to present evidence before the trial court on this question?
Well, Your Honor, they got...
Of inevitable discovery. The defense never knew this was going to come up. They had no idea, so they had no chance. They had no chance to argue or present evidence.
They were able to...
That this would not have been inevitably discovered.
They had the opportunity to file objections to the findings to the court. They could have filed a motion for reconsideration.
But the findings didn't have anything to do with inevitable discovery. What are they going to object to?
They could have... The memorandum decision held that the subpoena deus tecum, he was denied the right... He was denied his application for habeas corpus under inevitable discovery. Findings and conclusions were entered. Petitioner was given the opportunity and did object.
But isn't that what we're here about, is ineffective assistance of counsel that didn't object to him?
We're talking... Habeas counsel did object. He did object to that. He did object to the finding by the trial court that petitioner was denied habeas because of the inevitable discovery finding. He had that opportunity and he did file his objections.
But we have to go back to the trial proceedings where the evidence was admitted.
We're talking two different proceedings
now.
I'm sorry.
That's our problem in communication right now.
I apologize.
This wasn't raised at the trial level. The habeas counsel is objecting to the performance of trial counsel.
Correct.
So we have to focus on what happened at the trial.
I would agree with all of that. Again, under inevitable discovery, certainly the state was entitled to those records. They knew that there was a prescription. They got the prescription bottle on May 17th at petitioner's home. They knew there was a prescription for temazepam in petitioner's name. They also knew that there was a large quantity of temazepam found in Sharon's body. They also had talked, they eventually talked to Gene Thompson, who was the physician assistant who had issued the prescription for temazepam to petitioner. They had all of this information. And what the habeas court found is the state would have gotten to the point had they needed the search warrant of filing a request for the prescriptions. And in fact, the state or the habeas court also noted that in the affidavit for the search warrant that was filed in July of 1999, law enforcement specifically asked for prescription drugs and or remains of prescription drugs. That is included in the request for the search warrant.
Let me ask you this. How much did that play in the trial itself?
In reference to the prescription drugs and the computer search, well, that was the habeas court found that it did not change the results of the trial based upon the overwhelming evidence against petitioner.
Can you go into a little bit more detail on that?
Yes. Here's what some of the facts that the habeas court centered in on. There was a suicide specialist who testified that it did not seem plausible that Sharon would have committed suicide at that point in time. She had a daughter who was going to be married on June 5th, and she died on May 14th. She also died in a bathtub, and she was naked, and she was very self-conscious about her weight. The suicide specialist said none of this seems to make sense for somebody to commit suicide at that point in time and in that manner. There was a strained relationship, the court found, between Sharon and Guthrie. He had certainly told a number of people that he intended to divorce his wife. He told people she was fat, she was disgusting, he hated her, and he couldn't touch her. She disgusted him. Petitioner had a lot of differing stories as to what had happened. He was telling stories to one person, and then he'd tell a different story to another person. And all that, quite frankly, is laid out in the affidavit about his different storytelling. He proved himself to be a very, not a very good liar, but a prolific liar. His actions with his observed actions when Sharon was in the tub. He claimed that he had tried to get her out of the tub, but when the rescuers came, he was dry. The rescuers were soaking wet trying to get her out of the tub, yet he was dry. He didn't have any shoes and socks on. He claimed he'd gone over to do his daily devotions in the church and came back, but yet they found him with no shoes and socks on and dry clothes.
What did the state rely on this prescription drug in their final argument or anything of that nature to show intent or motive or whatever it was?
Your Honor, I'm not in a position to be able to recall specifically the state's closing arguments, and I apologize for that. The suicide notes that were found on the second computer cannot be overlooked. The computer that was put in, that was set up in petitioner's home after the church computer was seized by law enforcement, where there were suicide notes that were found that were created and modified after Sharon had died and were not disclosed until trial time. A card from another woman by the name of Kathy Keith from Wyoming, who was looking forward to having a rendezvous with petitioner as well. So not only did he have an affair going with Debbie Christensen in Nebraska, would appear that he was also seeing or had some interest in a woman in Wyoming and was making plans, in fact, to see this woman in Wyoming and move to Wyoming. There's also evidence that the week of Sharon's funeral, he was trying to make a plan, a scheduled event with Debbie Christensen in Wyoming. All of these things the habeas court factored into finding that there was not ineffective assistance of counsel. I think it's also important to note that habeas counsel, or trial counsel, testified in reference to the subpoena. It never occurred to him to file a motion to suppress. He had gone up against some pretty darn good attorneys in his day, and none of them had ever thought to do that. That was something that came 4 years later when he was successful in filing that motion in a financial case, and he thought, boy, I wish I would have done it in this other case. That would have been a good argument. That's not the standard for ineffective assistance of counsel. This court looks at the thought processes at the time of the trial. It doesn't Monday morning quarterback, and that's exactly what they're asking this court to do at this point in time. They came up with a new argument that might have carried some weight, but that doesn't mean he was ineffective at that point in time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Butler, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Monday morning quarterback. I thought what we were doing here was reviewing the record below to see whether trial counsel made errors such that it could have made a difference in the outcome of the trial. Appellate courts, I submit Monday morning quarterback for a living. So I just, the idea of standing up here and saying, let's just not get into what the thought processes were, people back then. I can tell you what the thought process was because he testified, Mr. Parent. Mr. Parent said with regard to using subpoena deuces tecums, he said the reason it never occurred to him to challenge it because when he was an assistant state's attorney in Lake County, they did the same thing. It apparently was not an uncommon practice for state's attorneys to get records in this fashion. Now, if he is wrong, if you are persuaded by the case before you now that there is a constitutional violation, then you have to make that call. I mean, it's not about deference to a decision that turned out to be incorrect. We don't defer to trial counsel's decision in that regard. Going back to the issue of the affidavit on the search warrant, the standard of proof is much discussed. This court has written it falls somewhere between reasonable suspicion, reasonable doubt. In Dubois, the court wrote there must be a substantial basis within the four corners of the affidavit to support the issuing court's decision to allow the search and seizure of a particular item. General warrants are what the Fourth Amendment was intended to guide against. General warrants that say he's committed a crime, go into his house and look for whatever you will. Get the computer, because it's possible he used it in some capacity. You know, hunches have to be supported by facts, even if we're going to parse the language out. I suggest when we look at it, when it says we want to look for his diary and his computer for evidence of a conspiracy. Now, nothing about that sentence suggests you're going to find the diary on the computer. They're clearly stating two separate things. If we're going to sit there now and read it to say, well, we're going to infer that, that is an unsubstantiated inference. It goes on to say they want to look, this is a separate statement in here, we would like to search for any correspondence, such as love letters or card, from Debbie Christensen. We would always like to look at people's computers to see what we can find about them when they're suspected of a crime. But that's not what the law, I suggest, permits. You have to have a reason to get into my computer. Just like you have to have a reason to get into my house, a reason to get into my car, a reason to get into my home. And nothing, again, I submit, if you carefully read through this affidavit, including the interview of Debbie Christensen, nothing indicates Debbie Christensen was going to be involved or was involved in criminal activity, number one. Number two, nothing says that Guthrie would have, in some level of likelihood, kept evidence of this crime on that computer. If we're simply going to say, well, it's possible, it's as good a place to look as any, I submit we have all but endorsed general warrants.
Let's assume for a minute that in reference to your ineffective assistance of counsel claim, you've proven on both of your counts the first prong, that he was that the attorney was ineffective. In view of the fact that they produce in evidence a suicide note which was prepared after her death on his computer, how do you overcome the harmless error argument? How do you prove prejudice in relation to that?
I'm going to take the words of the prosecutor from the trial record, volume 7, page 1005, in which he says their most damaging evidence against him was what came off of the office computer. And this court went through and set it out very clearly in the opinion upholding the conviction. The household searches, the bathtub searches, the prescription records, worst pills, best pills, temazepam shortly before her death. If you take that away and you take the temazepam prescriptions away from their case, they've got the suicidologist and the note, which was argued both ways in that case. This court knows in its 3-2 decision there was a lot of dispute about how far they could go with giving that opinion. But how did the jury view the suicidologist's testimony when it considered the evidence that came off the computer? When it considered the fact that temazepam had been prescribed to Mr. Guthrie and he obtained multiple prescriptions on or about the time his wife passed? How do you separate those out and say, we can still eliminate the computer information, the searches, and the prescriptions, and say it wouldn't have made a difference in this trial? That, to me, is going too far in assessing harmless error. Moreover, the lower court, with regard to its decision about the affidavit and the search warrant, never addressed harmless error on that part of it. It only addressed it in relationship to the prescription records, saying that even if those are out, it wouldn't have made a difference in the case. The court never analyzed the evidence coming from the computer. And I submit now to say 9 years later it's harmless. When you told the jury to convict him back in 2000, it was the most damaging evidence they had, is to stand the harmless error rule on its head. It didn't mean anything then. They should stand by their word then. One last thing on this inevitable discovery. It's inconceivable to me that the state can stand here now and still, when asked a question of the court, say we're not agreeing you had to get a search warrant. We still, 10 years later, we'll just not go along with that. But to argue that the habeas court was correct in saying they would have got a search warrant inevitably for his prescription records, those two arguments are mutually exclusive. You can't do both. I mean, there's a point where it's beyond legal fiction. It's just Kafkaesque to stand here and say that. They didn't believe they needed it then. They don't believe they need it now. So there's no reason to think they would have pursued a warrant in order to get the prescription records back in 99.
But Mr. Butler, I mean, they already had his prescription bottle. They had the toxicology. I mean, they ended up with toxicology reports which showed that he had the same prescription that was in lethal doses in her body. or toxic doses in the body. I mean, to suggest that they, I mean, isn't it almost ridiculous to suggest they wouldn't have pursued that?
What they found from those records was that he filled four different prescriptions, I believe, for 60 pills within X number of days.
2 minutes.
If you take that out, you have pill bottles in the home, and you have a toxic amount of it in her system. And you say, did Guthrie, in fact, go pick up that, those prescriptions within those several days? Was that the smoking gun in his hand? Well, I'll grant you this, that the more compelling case that I have on behalf of Mr. Guthrie for relief is the evidence seized from the computer. I'm not going to stand here and tiptoe up and merely insult your intelligence and say, if it's only about the prescription records, it's still not harmless error. I understand that. I can read a record as well as anybody. But the evidence from the computer coupled with the prescription records, if this court is to hold that this search warrant should not have issued on the basis of the information contained in it for the computer, and the prescription records should not have been obtained by subpoena, there is no question but that you can look at this and say Mr. Guthrie was in fact prejudiced, and that there is a possibility of a different outcome in this case, because it is impossible to separate the two out. And again, I conclude by saying, when the state says it was its most damaging evidence, I thank you for your time and your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.